you ever wistfully wonder if the coffee of your dreams is going to step right off the screen and into your life? Well, what if I told you that that exceptional fresh roasted coffee doesn't have to be fictional? It's here, and it's just a few clicks away. I'm talking about Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this fetching coffee to your home or office in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. You can order Sparkplug as you need it or join the Autopilot Coffee Club. It's not a coffee of the month club. The Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club is totally flexible and customizable, and it comes with all kinds of member benefits. All the convenience, none of the commitment. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is offering 20% off your next coffee order. It applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? It's time to start making your favorite cup of coffee in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi, hi, movie fans, and thank you very much for devouring the next 192 project, the Monday morning chit-chat about motion pictures that many consider to be classics. I say Monday morning, and ironically, we're recording this on a Monday morning. Our podcasting start was in March 2013 when we embarked on a quest to review all 123 titles on the AFI's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. Once we completed that effort in December 2015, we started talking about this, that, and the other. And if you aren't gunned about spoilers, then vamoose, because we're about to spoil. I'm the poet, explorer, and adventurer, Ryan Ellis of the Hamilton Ellises. And here's the fetching lady who's full of cheerful bravado and wears a pith helmet to New York City nightclubs. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture. The Purple Rose of Cairo. Mia Farrow was in 13 Woody Allen flicks. I know Woody Allen. We'll get to that in a few minutes. Tainted, I know. Many of them are among Woody's best. I would say four of them are bona fide classics, in fact. Which of those 13 do you prefer?
I've only seen a handful of the collaborations. And the only two that really stick out for me, or the ones that stick out for me the most, are this one and Hannah and Her Sisters. I'm going to say this one because seeing Woody Allen on screen repulses me now. But also, I actually think it might genuinely be the best one. We picked this film because in both of our cases, it's among our very favorite Woody Allen films.
Mm-hmm. It's one of his favorites, too. The four I said that are bona fide classics, that's, of course, an opinion thing. But I would say Zelig, a couple years before this, is one of those. Hannah and Her Sisters, yeah. And also Crimes and Misdemeanors in 1989. So all in the 80s, all in the span of about, 6 years? But of all the ones they've done, yeah, Purple Rose of Cairo is my favorite. It doesn't hurt that he's not on screen, although they say he's the guy putting up the movie marquee at one point, but that doesn't count.
No.
I didn't know that till I read the trivia and didn't recognize him. Even when I was looking for him, I thought, is that really actually Woody Allen or is somebody just wrong? Sometimes the IMDb trivia is flat out wrong. Okay, The Purple Rose of Cairo was released 35 years and one day ago by Orion Pictures, who are now defunct, on April 19th, 1985. It lost money, which is not uncommon for Woody Allen films. Not that his movies are huge busts. They don't cost $250 million to make or even $100 million to make. But this movie was in the red. And it shouldn't have been. People should have went to see it. But anyway, remind people the movie is about Bev with The Purple Rose of Cairo. Skinny.
Mia Farrow is Cecilia, a put-upon wife and waitress struggling to survive in New Jersey during the Great Depression. To escape, Cecilia goes to the movies and falls in love with the characters, until one of the characters falls in love right back. Jeff Daniels' Tom steps right off the screen and into reality to woo Cecilia and escape the pictures. A happy ending! Until you consider how Tom's defection affects the studio, the actor who plays him, Cecilia's husband, and the remaining characters in the film who can't move on to the next reel until Tom returns.
So it's a fantasy film, if we didn't already make that clear. Or, in a nutshell, walking movie encyclopedia can't stop watching a film that looks like a mediocre piece of crap. She's Quentin Tarantino. He likes a lot of garbage. He's a huge fan of, that's one reason why he did things like Death Proof and even Kill Bill. He's a big fan of that kind of stuff, and so was Cecilia in this movie, because The Purple Rose of Cairo, which is the movie within the movie, doesn't look very good. Looks like the kind of film that was made that cost a couple hundred thousand dollars for, RKO Radio Pictures in this movie. That's who actually released it. doesn't look like it's any good, yet she keeps on going over and over and over. The movie marathon thing where she sits there all day long when she has nothing else to do, partly, but I think she would have done that if she could have anyway. All right, the Rotten Tomatoes critics, 92% of them liked the film, 34 fresh, 3 rotten, for an average of 7.9 out of 10, and 88% of audiences. Damn good numbers there. The film was 78th at the 1985 U.S. box office. Back to the Future, which we covered many years ago, was number 1. Rocky IV, which Chris and I covered a couple years ago, was number 3. And you and I also covered Lost in America. That was 83rd that year.
I love that movie.
And it actually made less money than Purple Rose of Cairo. Yeah, both of them were hilarious and should have been watched by people over and over again. This film was nominated for only one Oscar, the original screenplay. Woody Allen's been nominated for, I think, a record number of those Oscars. I think it's always been original as well, never adapted with him. The script won the Golden Globe, and Woody Allen took home the Fipresci, I think is how you pronounce it, award at Cannes. And also, the Oscar in 1985 for best screenplay went to, can you guess? It's a good one. It's a really good one, but I set it up for this reason.
I never know years.
Witness.
Oh, God, I never would have guessed that.
And it won over Back to the Future, Brazil, and Purple Rose of Cairo, which I think are all better and more original screenplays than Witness.
I was going to say, like, if the screenplay award for original screenplay went to originality, well, then, yeah, you'd have very different winners every
year. Any one of those three are more original than Witness.
I've actually never seen Witness.
Well, the movies that probably should be watched during the COVID.
We have been really filling in all of my gaps. That is how we're taking advantage of the pandemic shutdown.
COVID-19 has brought about films in our eyeballs we've been meaning to watch for years. She's finally seen some Peckinpah films I've been meaning to show her for a long time. And also, Purple Rose was nominated for 3 AFI lists. The Top 100 Laughs. Woody Allen had other films on that list. I wouldn't say this necessarily was worthy of that. The Top 100 Passions. Might have been a decent choice for that. And this would have been appropriate. The Top 100 Genres in the Fantasy category. Except, that was a great category, including Back to the Future. So it wouldn't have made that. But it was nominated for those three. Okay, you saw this with me, I think, many years ago, right? But our review here for this podcast, what'd you think of The Purple Rose of Cairo?
I really, really love this film. It is sweet and it's funny, but it combines that sweet, goofy watchability with a kind of bleak but meaningful ending, and it pulls it off. You talked about the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. I'm surprised that they weren't lower just because the ending really takes a chance and asks the audience to go to a dark place with Cecilia at the end of the film, but I don't think anybody watching the film could deny that it's the right ending, and it's gutsy. Most films would not have done that. They would have given her a happy ending of some kind, even if it was just to kick her crummy husband to the curb, but it doesn't even give us that. You kind of suspect she's going to go back to him. Mm-hmm. Anyways, it ironically gives us this anti-Hollywood ending instead of indulging our fantasies, which brings all the themes to bear and forces us to come to terms with what he's trying to say. And it does all this dark stuff, all of this artistic work, while still giving us such a delightful, whimsical, fun film to watch. Comes in pretty much around an hour and a half.
Not even.
Accomplishes so much in such a short period of time. The second viewing was just as good as the first, which is high praise.
I was thinking about this when prepping for the podcast, that if I had to pick one Woody Allen film and only one to keep on the shelf, that's asking a lot when somebody's made as many movies as he has. It'd be hard not to pick Annie Hall or Manhattan, but it might be this one. I've seen those two more, but this movie has so many great things in it. So many movies he's made, love stories, because he often, or almost always, I guess, focus on love stories, where it doesn't work out. Annie Hall, they don't stay together. Manhattan, they don't stay together. Crimes and Misdemeanors, the two, Woody Allen and Mia Farrow's characters, don't stay together. I don't remember some of the other ones.
He ends up with one of the sisters. Spoiler.
Well, that's actually a happy ending by his standards.
It is. Yeah, it's true.
Most characters get what they want in that. At least, well, his character and Diane Wiest, yeah, that's who he marries in that film. But in this, I think if you change the ending, you ruin it. And you just said that a minute ago. And yet the studio told him if you did change that ending, you'd have a hit. Woody's ending is so much better because in the end, and I think you said this too, and you're skinny, she's in love with movies. Yes, she's in love with the character of Tom Baxter, and then she seems to fall in love with Gil Shepard, the real guy. Jeff Daniels plays both, of course. But she's in love with film itself. She's such a filmholic. I mentioned Tarantino. Well, that makes a lot of sense because so is he. Woody was quoted as saying, this movie is a seduction of fantasy as opposed to the pain of real life. And that's, I guess, why she goes to the movies, because that's her escape.
And he said that he could have picked novels or any other form of fantasy, but picking the movies made for this great cinematic idea. But he's like, this is a stand-in for all the escapism that we indulge in.
And also he was quoted as saying that life is ultimately disappointing. And the great love stories. I was looking at this as well. The AFI's Top 100 Passions. I didn't write down what they all are, but I know Casablanca's in there. They don't end up together. Gone with the Wind, they don't end up together. West Side Story, they don't end up together. I'm forgetting a lot of them right now.
Love Story.
Right. And a lot of times it's death. Dr. Zhivago is another one. I think that's in the top 10. So I think he's actually in line with how the great love stories work, which is they don't end up happily ever after. All right, let's get the Woody Allen thing out of the way. Then we can actually talk about the movie itself, which I guess we've already done. But I have some reservations about the accusations against him, unlike Cosby and Weinstein, the ones that if you don't believe that, then you are just going to be in denial.
You're telling on yourself.
But the Woody Allen thing is it's one accuser. Now, one is enough, I guess. A lot of people would make that argument. Certainly, Ronan Farrow has made that argument. And I don't blame him. He feels like his sister was abused by this man, who is not even probably his real father. Supposed to be, but isn't
probably.
Really.
What do you think?
Right. But I'll let you have the floor about this, because I don't think this one's as clear-cut as other ones. And I can watch movies made by these awful people. Spacey's another one. I think I've seen at least a couple Spacey movies since that all came out and didn't really dwell on it. I definitely have seen Woody Allen films since it came out about what he supposedly did to Dylan many years ago. But okay, go ahead.
Well, I more or less agree with you that people who insist that you can't enjoy the art of bad people are impossibly inflexible, realistically, if you look back into history and you nitpick the personal behavior of every person who ever created something that the world loved and was inspired by. You're not going to be left with as much as you think you are.
Almost nothing, probably.
It's just a pretty deep chasm to fall into to run purity tests on every single creation. And I have mixed feelings about it because I don't think there is a perfect answer. Some artists bother me more than others. And it's funny how I can watch a Polanski film without feeling that much reservations about it, even though there's no question Polanski confessed to the rape of a child that he drugged.
And then ran away.
Then took off to avoid justice. He's a disgusting man. He's a criminal. He's a bad person who's really hurt people. But I still watch Chinatown. I still think that movie is a masterpiece, and it bothers me a little, but it doesn't bother me that much.
You've made the point before, though, that he's not, well, he is a little bit in that movie, but he's not really on screen. And in this case, with Woody Allen, with Purple Rose of Cairo, not on screen. If we had to look at the face of the person that did these things, Spacey, you can't avoid it. He produced some movies he wasn't actually in, including one we covered this year, The Social Network. But for the most part, he's on screen. Bill Cosby is on screen.
That's the other thing. There's some people where, because it's so much about their personality, Bill Cosby convinced us he was playing himself. Woody Allen convinced us he was playing himself. He had this character. This was his persona. We were all kind of supposed to bleed his persona with who he is in real life. We all know that he's playing a character of sorts, but he's playing the same character in most of his movies. I can't believe anybody can still watch Manhattan. Manhattan is a movie.
He's confessing. If he actually did that to his daughter, basically confessing his desires.
And another thing about Woody Allen is, do we believe Dylan? Do we not believe Dylan? I lean towards believing her, but I agree with you that it's just not as clear cut as a lot of these cases. And there's a lot more cause for doubt. But there's like a lot of cause to believe her, too. There was an eyewitness to what happened outside of her, one of their housekeepers or babysitters, and some other statements that back up what she said. But I always thought that Woody Allen was a scumbag because he married his stepdaughter. What he did with his stepdaughter, it makes me gag when I even just say it out loud. And because I was pretty young when that happened, it's always tainted his films for me. I can acknowledge that Annie Hall is a brilliant film. I think it's wonderful and hilarious and charming. But it's always a little bit tainted for me because he's the star of it. It's just all these gray areas. It's impossible to really say one way or the other whether these things can still be enjoyed. Can I still listen to Michael Jackson's music? Well, to be honest, no. It's not as fun for me as it used to be. That doesn't make me a purist. I'm not judging anybody who still enjoys. I guess that's really what it boils down to. I have my own feelings about what I can and cannot enjoy, but I really don't feel that it's necessary to get mad at you because you can still watch Manhattan, because you still enjoy that movie. On whatever level it appeals to you, it appeals to you. That doesn't make me mad. I just can't. Same with people who are always going to rock out to Michael Jackson or can still listen to an old Bill Cosby routine or watch a Cosby show and get past it. Okay, that's just not for me to judge. I think everybody has a different tolerance for it. But the fact is, these people's behavior does spoil their work, and that's on them. We can't be mad at people for being purists about it. Let's be mad at Woody Allen for being a despicable criminal who clearly has some really messed up issues with women. And then it's impossible for me not to watch his movies with that in mind. That being said, that just doesn't apply to Purple Rose of Cairo because there's no Woody Allen cipher. Like, it's an unusual film.
Mia Farrow is doing the stammering, stuttering thing.
I disagree. You said that when we watched
it. She's doing it.
She's doing the stammering thing and that she's doing something of an impersonation, but I don't think that her character, her motivations, her behaviors reflect that typical narcissistic, overthinking, neurotic Woody Allen character that's in most of his films. She's not like that. She's a doormat. She's not playing that character that tends to be the lead in all of his films. And it's strangely unique in the sense that there's nobody in the film that represents that character of his. Not like it's the only film of his that does that. We talked about Zelig, even though he's in it, it doesn't have that Woody Allen character that's in all of his films. So maybe that's part of the reason why I can just kick back and enjoy this movie on the level it's meant to be enjoyed.
Well, you've made that point to me before, and maybe some people, lots of people probably don't agree with you, that not seeing them is a big part of it. Because if you were to do this whole purity test, then so many Miramax films are out the window because of Harvey Weinstein. But he's never on screen, so I think that's a fair analysis. And also, purity test stuff, Twitter people, they can suck a dick because they are nuts about a lot of things, I think. That's a little bit strong, maybe, but the whole Bernie Biden thing now. If people aren't going to just completely absolve them, I can understand objections to that. Larry David recently said about Woody Allen that he just simply believes him. But then that's his opinion. And if you don't want to support Larry David anymore, then I think you're being unreasonable.
Keep falling
down.
Can
sort of understand that one, though, because that's saying, Larry David at least is saying, I believe him. I don't think he did it. My whole thing is, I don't know either way, but there's enough stress in life. We have to stress about every little thing that
people do. Yeah, I have enough things to worry
about.
I'm not
trying to slough off.
I can't be like judge, jury, and executioner for what did or did not happen with Woody Allen.
And I'm not trying to slough off the idea that he may have molested his young daughter. That's not fair for me to put it, oh, this is another thing. But there's so much for us to worry about, and this one is a little more dubious than others. Okay, let's talk about the movie now. We had to cover that issue, and we did. But let's go back into this wonderful, funny film that he's not in. Incidentally, you just said that this isn't the Woody Allen cipher, at least the way it usually is. But one thing that is similar as well, not just the stammering, stuttering aspect, is that Woody Allen almost always is battling multiple women. Well, so is Cecilia in this movie, because she's married to Monk, and then she's got two men on her ass, if you will. First, the fake one, Tom Baxter. I love the line when he has the fight with Monk and he doesn't bleed. And he says, that's one of the advantages of being imaginary. So even then, this character doesn't believe that he's real at that point. He still is saying, literally, I'm imaginary. But then the real guy, Gil Shepard, pretends he's in love with her. But I think he at least likes her. It's a really key moment when you see him on the plane back to Hollywood when they finally got everything back in order and Tom Baxter has gone back into the movie and Cecilia's left out to dry, which is shitty. But the look on Gil's face is, I did the right thing, what they told me I had to do, but I don't feel good about it. And that's an important look on his face, Jeff Daniels, who is underrated. He's had a hell of a good career. We've covered him a few times. Terms of Endearment, Speed. We've both agreed that the best thing about The Newsroom, the TV show, by far, was him, especially, as I've talked before, in the pilot when he has that big speech, which I've watched on YouTube 20 or 30 times. It's an underrated career. He's been a really good actor for a long time, never been nominated for an Oscar. Michael Keaton, though, originally had this role. And I think he was actually filming. But then Woody realized, much like Back to the Future that year, we've talked about that already, where they were filming for a while with Eric Stoltz, and they had to fire him because he wasn't being funny. And I didn't read that Michael Keaton wasn't being funny enough. I can't imagine Michael Keaton not being funny, but I think maybe what it was is he seemed like he was just not the period guy. He didn't really fit as far as being
a 1930s
person, real person, or a film star.
Yeah, there weren't like a lot of film stars in the 30s with those eyebrows and that sarcastic wittiness that he has. He just didn't fit. And Allen has been open about saying this was totally his own mistake. Keaton was doing a great job. It's just that it was miscasting. I also saw that Kevin Kline could have had the part. And
he would have been good.
Not impugning Daniels at all. I think he's wonderful in this film. But Kevin Kline, we maybe missed out on such an exceptional performance. I think he would have imagined just him as Tom, just being that idealist, that naive. Oh, he would have been amazing. I get the feeling that the character of Gil, who's the actor that plays Tom, right? I feel like it's a dig on some of the actors Allen has known and worked with. I've had my share of run-ins in my life with people who perform for a living in one way or another. And while it's certainly not true of all of them, Gil is a pretty accurate representation of the type of person who becomes a performer for a living, and that they all have this absolute black hole of insecurity that can never be filled. And no matter how successful they are, there's always the panic that they're going to lose it and people don't like them enough and they have to have constant affirmations. And his panic of his career being damaged by what's happening is all he really cares about, so that when you see him on the plane, and I agree with you, that moment is so important. Is he feeling guilty? He seems pretty miserable in that moment. Does he feel bad about what he did?
He'll get over it, but he's not just sloughing it off this fast.
No,
either.
No, because Cecilia, even if you aren't going to fall in love with her, nobody could know her and then say, forget it. I don't care what happens to this dum-dum. He's not a sociopath. He's just somebody who desperately needs approval so bad that he'll do whatever it takes to keep his career in Hollywood.
Well, he's pompous and he's easily flattered, as we see when he's first introduced when he's out in Hollywood. Believes his own hype, obviously, too. And he's probably a mediocre actor, like I said before. This movie that he's in isn't very good by the looks of it. It's the kind of movie you saw 100 times over back then by all the studios. Warner Brothers or RKO or MGM made a lot of movies like this that were pumped out fast and were kind of mediocre.
But the movie is strongly implying that part of the reason that Tom walked off the screen is because Gil put so much life into this character and made him so real that he became real. And the studio's like, oh, maybe we can't cast this guy anymore if he's going to keep creating characters that are so realistic.
They do say that other Tom Baxters are coming out of the movie or just talking to the audience in other cities. It's not just this one in New Jersey. That's where this movie's set, by the way, in New Jersey. Woody usually set his movies in New York specifically, but this one's in New Jersey and also a little bit in Hollywood with Gil Shepard and the film people. And they shot mostly in New Jersey, too, in November 1983. And then the movie came out well over a year later. I don't know why it took so long in post-production. And it's set in 1935, so during the Great Depression, like you already said. So yeah, Tom put life into the character, but then there's also the point that Woody's making, I think, as an in-joke. Is it the actor's creation or the writer's creation? I think maybe Cecilia's the one who brings that up. Well, didn't the writer write those lines? Yeah, but I gave them life. A good movie, a good play, a good TV show, when you have to have somebody adapting what someone else wrote, unless the person's playing the character themselves, like, of course, Woody Allen did so often in his career, or still does, I think, even now. Although, I don't know if he really acts much anymore, does he? He still makes movies, but I don't know if he's really acting. Anyway, he's acted lots of times in his movies, so that's a little different. He can literally say it exactly as he wrote it, because he knows better than anyone. But in most cases, you have to adapt what someone else wrote. And I bet if you talked to the writer and just got them completely being honest with you, way more often than not, even maybe some of the great movies, they'd say, nah, but Bill didn't really get what I was going for there, at least in that one moment, if not the whole movie. Or Jack, as great as Nicholson is, or Redford, or I don't know, you name all the actors, Jane Fonda, really good, but...
How often on the other side of that does an actor take a just okay script and absolutely inject it with exactly what it needs to be interesting or realistic? They actually do polish that turd and make something mediocre into something amazing. I think it goes both ways.
And that's what Gil would say he's doing in this movie he's made with these obviously accomplished actors within the film. They're funny, too, because they're always waiting around. That's one thing that comes up, too, is one of those reasonably good questions. How can they run this movie for days and days and days on end? And how does it not eventually just wear the movie out? You have to re-rack the film, basically. I don't know exactly. Well, it's obviously a fantasy, so you let that go, I guess. But these actors in the movie, the characters in the movie, know just as much as Tom that he's not in the movie. They're very aware, too. That's a nice touch. It could have just been that Tom left and they don't know where he is or why he's not in the scene with them. But they're self-aware as well. And it's funny whenever somebody goes back into that theater, the movie is often in the theater itself. So it's really truly a movie about movies. But the actors are constantly having to wait around. And that's some funny stuff, too.
And we learn that each of those, we call them actors, but they're really characters.
Right.
Each of those characters have the script that they follow, but they also have their own little private wants and needs that have nothing to do with the story that they're performing for the audience every night. And it leads to the best joke. I laugh every time I think about it, which is when they eventually do make it to the nightclub and the maitre d' realizes that there's a table for seven instead of six and his whole brain explodes. He can't believe that they're going off script. And the second he realizes it, it's like he's in a lucid dream or something. And he's like, finally, I can do this. And he does this amazing tap dance for the audience. And it's so outstanding and incredible. He's actually really good at it and just comes out of nowhere and indulges the audience in his indulgence.
Because Cecilia's now part of that. She's in the nightclub at the Copa.
Yeah, and all hell is breaking loose because there's no rules.
And she shouldn't be there. Yeah. Tom should be, and he's finally back where he belongs. But now she's in the movie. One thing I loved about that scene as much as anything, though, is the slightly tinny audio.
Oh, they did such a great job of replicating what an old film would look and sound like.
Well, Woody was never thought of as a technical director, but around this time is when he did his best technical film. Zelig was Forrest Gump before Forrest Gump. They're putting Zelig into all kinds of things with Babe Ruth and I think with all kinds of world leaders from around this time frame in the 30s with the Hitlers of the world and that kind of thing. And considering it had to be done with film and not with special effects that we could do now, it would be fairly easy to do that. Forrest Gump, it was tough, but it's a lot easier than it was in Zelig. And this movie is very technical too. right down to having Daniels act against himself here and there. And that's just a split screen. They've done that forever, but it's pretty seamless. I didn't see any kind of obviousness where you could say, okay, that's where they splice the film together the way they do that. And if you want to know, you can look up how they do that. But this movie is based on other classic films, which makes sense considering how much it loves movies. Sherlock Jr., where the Buster Keaton character goes into the movie rather than the character coming out of the movie. But Last Action Hero has the same concept as this. Schwarzenegger acts against himself at one point in that movie. So the actual Arnold Schwarzenegger and then the Jack Slater character. I watched Last Action Hero again not that long ago. I hadn't seen it in a long time. It isn't great, but considering people have often said it's one of the worst movies of the 90s, it really isn't at all. It's pretty good. It may not be great, but it's at least pretty good. And it is very much the same concept as this. The guy comes out of the movie, not because he's frustrated with what's going on, so that concept's not the same. But a lot of the same kind of jokes in this movie with Tom when he starts to kiss Cecilia and says, where's the fade out? And he thinks the car's just going to go on its own, but he has to start it first. He tries to use money, but he's only got fake money. He's got a lot of it, but he's only got fake money. So they have to do the dine and dash at one point. So that's where a lot of the jokes come from, is the fish out of water stuff.
It's like a fantasy film that's all about fantasies falling apart once you apply the slightest bit of pragmatism. And the metaphor plays out really elegantly, as well as being cute and charming. But as you say, the fantasy can only last so long. They can't live in the abandoned amusement park. He can't pay for things with his fake money. And you can just see how there's going to reach a time where he's going to fail to make it in the real world because of one deficiency or another.
If he decided to stay.
If he decided to stay. And maybe on a level, Cecilia knows that too. Actually, I think she does. She doesn't just tell him to go back to the world of the film because Gil is romancing her. That helps her, but I think there's a part of her that seems to be like, I'm not just choosing him over you. You're imaginary. You belong in the imaginary world. So even though the last thing we see is her in the movie theater indulging in fantasy again, the one bit of hope at the end of the film is that she's doing this with the introspection of knowing this isn't real and that her real life is still something she's going to have to deal with. So maybe you have a little more hope that maybe she will have left Monk for good. Yeah, I know. You're making a face at me right now. No, I don't think so either. I'm sure that optimistic people would think that, well, at least she left Monk. And you're like, no, but she left Monk before and she went back to him because she had nowhere else to go. Don't get the impression that her sister and her sister's family are going to let her live with them forever. She truly has nowhere else to go. She doesn't have a job. She has no means of looking after herself. And also, she's just conditioned to believe that a marriage is what she deserves.
This movie's not cynical, but it doesn't believe the fantasy that she believed for a long time. And I don't know if she's fixed. Well, it's the wrong word anyway. But if she's cured of what is going on in her life, well, she can't be. Because I think she's going to be back with Monk. But I will do the What Happens Next now. I think Ginger Rogers comes out of the screen next time. Because she's watching Top Hat at the end, which you've never seen. We should watch that. You hated Swing Time, but I do remember Top Hat being better.
If I could just watch the dance sequences and music in Swing Time, then I probably would have thought it was a wonderful movie. And I like to think I can just approach Top Hat with that in mind.
But anyway, if Ginger Rogers comes out of the screen, that's good. Because a woman might treat Cecilia right. Although Tom does as the character, but Gil...
Tom is imaginary.
Not so much.
He's a fantasy. It's funny when you were saying earlier, other Woody Allen films include Woody, you specifically use the word battling several women. Instead of...
I said battling?
You said battling.
Well, I didn't mean
and I
that,
thought that
then.
Was so interesting, but it's an interesting little Freudian slip there.
I meant to say juggling.
Yeah, but you did not. You said battling. Oh, okay. I'm almost positive. It's a funny little slip, though, that you said that because you never feel like this is necessarily a pleasure to have several men fighting for your affections. I don't really think it's a pleasure for him in the movies where he has several women that he's juggling. It's always a dilemma. It's not nice to have all that attention. It's more like, oh, when it rains, it pours, and then you have to make a pretty difficult decision.
His character's not happy in Manhattan, and in Annie Hall, he can never say to her, I love you. He says, I love you. And those might be his two best movies overall. Well, I like this one probably even more than those, but talk about just what best is. Although he always had that great joke about his earlier, funnier ones. In, I forget what movie it was, but aliens say that to him or something like that. All right, well, the life that Cecilia's escaping in this movie is that she's a waitress and not a very good one because she's just obsessed with film. She knows all about the movies. She knows all about the star's history. And her sister, Mia Farrow's sister, plays her fellow waitress, who's supposed to be her sister in the movie itself, too. So more meta stuff. Is this movie meta? And then we meet Monk not long after. That's the Danny Aiello character. He's pitching pennies, which is effectively like gambling. But he's abusive. He was also laid off from the factory, which isn't an excuse, but he would say, that's why, you make me hit you, that kind of stuff. And he's also cheating with Olga. So he's bad in many ways. And well played by Aiello, who a couple years later would be in Moonstruck, and then a couple years after that would be in The Great Do the Right Thing. It's not like this is sleeping with the enemy. He's not that abusive. He's not that terrible. Except
ever
to run
that
away.
He's going
to
kill her.
But this is the life she's probably going back to, because I think Woody Allen is saying that you can enjoy the fantasy for a while, but things have to get back to normal. And in a depression, what else is she going to do? She's obviously not trained to do much of anything else anyway. She's been a housewife. That was really just shrugged off back then. People shrug it off even now, but people tend to have more respect for women in general, I think, than they did back in the 30s. It's like Richard Gere says in An Officer and a Gentleman, I've got nowhere else to go. We got to watch that movie on.
Yeah, that's another one I've never seen.
While we're stuck inside still. And she does try to leave, but of course has nowhere to go. So all she has is the movies and does this Purple Rose marathon when finally Tom notices her and says, you've been here a lot lately. Oh, one thing I didn't say earlier when we were talking about the actors, or the characters, I guess, within the actual Purple Rose of Cairo movie within this movie. It reminded me so much of one of the great lines in any film. Probably should have been nominated for the quotes list, but it has to be in context. And in Shakespeare in Love, when you see the guy who's playing the nurse in the play they're putting on when they're doing the first ever Romeo and Juliet, you hear it in the background as somebody's asking him, what's the play about? And he says, well, there's this nurse. That epitomizes actors right there. And you know that the actors within the Purple Rose storyline feel that way. The Countess and the Edward Herman and Van Johnson characters. Those guys
The
Maitre d' as well, yeah. Yeah, Edward Herman and Van Johnson acted forever. Van Johnson was in The Caine Mutiny, another movie we probably should watch at some point. Humphrey Bogart, maybe his best performance, certainly one of his best performances. But you know that those characters and probably the actors who play them are thinking the same thing, which is, I'm not the star, but there's this Countess, and that's not at all what the story is really about. Or the waiter at the Copa. Diane Weiss is in this film, too, and she won the Oscar the next year. Yeah, Hen and Her Sisters was the next year. She won two with Woody. She made five movies with him over the next 9 years. So she won the Oscar for Hen and Her Sisters, supporting actors. And then she won again for Bullets Over Broadway. And she was great in that movie, but I really wish they'd given it in retrospect to Jennifer Tilly, because they both were nominated, and Tilly was probably even better. And Tilly's never won since, but Weiss already had. Our dog's name is Tilly. Anyway, Weiss plays a prostitute in this, and we see Glenn Headley as another prostitute in this. I think it's one of her first pictures. That sequence is fun, where Tom doesn't know where he is. He doesn't understand he's in a whorehouse, and he charms them. Even though the movie's really short, I'm not really sure that needs to be in the movie at all. But I guess it's to give Tom something to do, rather than hanging out at the amusement park all day long. And that's another Woody Allen recurring theme. In Annie Hall, I think it is, where supposedly he grew up underneath a roller coaster.
Yes.
There are amusement parks in a lot of his films. I think it's called Wonder Wheel, that he did with Kate Winslet. And of course, in this, where Tom Baxter's hanging out in an amusement park for days on end. So Woody brings back a lot of things from his youth. Radio Days is all about how he grew up on the radio, which would have been true for him for a while anyway, because TV wouldn't have been around for a while. He was born in 1935 when this movie is set. So I don't know how long it was till TV came in. Was that the 40s or 50s? Middle class people would have probably not had television sets until the 50s at least, because rich people might have had them earlier, but his family wouldn't have. What do you think about her choice between the character who she's actually fallen in love with and who's fallen in love with her, or the real person who's pretending he's in love with her, but again, not being a complete jerk about it?
Well, a lesser film would have just had her run away with Tom, the way Splash ends. When you think about the ending of Splash for more than 30 seconds, you're like, wait a minute, how's he gonna live under the sea? It's the same sort of thing. They could have given us the happy ending, the fantasy, the rush of music and emotions and the big kiss and fades to black. But the fact is that Cecilia, while she indulges in fantasy, is actually rooted in the real world. And that is why she knows that Gil's offer, false as it may be, she doesn't know that, is a much better offer. It's much more likely to save her from her dire circumstances than what Tom is offering her, which is completely unrealistic. So she's making a pragmatic choice. It's romantic, too. Gil really does romance her. If you, as a viewer, taking all pragmatism away, you would root for Tom. He's the better option. He's the better person. I'm using quotation marks. But I think it's just a nod to the fact that Cecilia, when it comes down to it, is not crazy. I love, you know, we haven't really talked that much about how they treat the fantasy in the film, that they treat it in this very pragmatic way. None of the characters in the film are that amazed that a character walked off the screen and became a whole person. Something that should cause each and every one of them to question the nature of God and the universe, but instead they're just kind of like, what's this gonna do for box office? They're very worried about the very pragmatic things of a character becoming real. It's so funny. It's so funny, and it's such a great way of telling the audience not to worry about things like, how is the reel still playing? That reel should have run out.
For days.
Yeah, exactly. And they're even talking about how they can't go on to the next reel because Tom isn't there. Pragmatically, that reel would have run out of film, and that would have been the end of all of them. It's that mix of dealing with fantasy and pragmatism, but it also makes it more, I guess, sound that Cecilia is also bridging the gap between fantasy and reality, but always with one foot in pragmatism.
It's also a black and white movie, and then he's color. So when he walks out of the movie, he goes from black and white to color.
Oh, yeah, I never thought
And the
that.
Audience has the same sort of non-reaction. It's one thing for the professionals not to really react very much. You could argue they've seen this before.
The audience who's seen something that is absolutely impossible are more annoyed that the film has become boring and they don't do anything except sit around and complain about how Tom's not there. Meanwhile, it's like, you can interact with the characters on screen. And none of them are impressed. They're like, I want my money back.
I don't think it happens with Top Hat, but we do hear Cheek to Cheek in the opening credits and at the end of the film, which is very appropriate. I'm not sure Woody did that very often. He always had, and still does, always have really old music in his opening black and white credits. He's done it the exact same way, if not every single film, but certainly since the mid-70s. And here we are 45 plus years later since he started doing that. And this is one of the rare times I can think of where it's a bookend having that famous song from Top Hat. One actor we didn't mention who's not in the movie is Viggo Mortensen. He was cast in a small part and he was thrilled about it because he hadn't really gotten his start in Hollywood yet, but then it was cut out, which happens with a lot of Woody films. You read about this in many of his movies where somebody's in it, sometimes a big player, and they're cut right out. And this movie's not long at all. It's not even an hour and 25 minutes long. But interestingly, we mentioned Witness earlier. Viggo Mortensen's in that the exact same year as this. So it took a while for his career to really take off, but it wasn't like he didn't do anything that year. He was in the very acclaimed Witness. So Woody Allen, we've talked about his career already plenty and his personal life. This is one of his favorites of his own movies. It achieved what he envisioned more than most do. He didn't even like Manhattan. And you can say you don't like Manhattan, but a lot of people do. It's on a lot of the list of great films. And before he was tainted in a lot of eyes for marrying his stepdaughter or, of course, for what he may have done to his actual daughter, that was a movie that people put up there with one of the great films. What a beautiful black and white movie that is. Forget the storyline, just how great it is to look at. But he didn't like that movie. He wished they'd shelved it. But this one he actually seems to truly like, along with Match Point, another one he likes of his own movies. I'm not a huge fan of that one. I think that also has a tragic ending where they don't end up together. A love story, effectively.
He's one of those directors that makes a movie a year, if not more. He compares himself to Bergman, not in the sense that he thinks he's as good as Bergman, but he compares himself to Bergman in the sense that he just makes a movie because he wants to try something. And he is willing to perform experiments in his films and try things, and sometimes they absolutely fall flat. A lot of people, even his biggest fans, would admit that he's had a lot of stinkers, but then sometimes those experiments pay off because they work. That's just the nature of the way that he likes to create. Kudos to filmmakers like that. They're going to fail sometimes, but then sometimes you get something like Purple Rose of Cairo. And I think Annie Hall, the film was supposed to be completely different, and they just put it all together in the editing suite and turned into a love story because the original plot didn't really work.
It was a Manhattan murder mystery in the 70s rather than when he actually finally made it with Diane Keaton in the 90s.
Yeah, and they just performed surgery instead and created Annie Hall out of what they had. Talk about a successful experiment. Obviously, he does certain things very well. He's legitimately very funny, and he, I think, has a really keen understanding of what makes people root for a character, no matter how bad they are. But he tends to be more gutsy than particular about how his films turn out. And this is the reward that you get from something like this. As much as I love someone like David Fincher as a filmmaker, I can't imagine David Fincher ever successfully making something like Purple Rose of Cairo in a million years. As soon as you overthink this film, it would start to fail.
Nolan, Scorsese, I don't think they could do it either. Not like this. They don't have that sense of twee. I guess maybe Wes Anderson might be able to pull it off, but they don't have that sense of romance the same way. Those kinds of guys have made movies that have aimed to be something like this, maybe, but not many filmmakers could pull off something like this, and maybe not even Zelig. I guess obviously Zemeckis could, because he made a very similar film in Forrest Gump, which we just watched again a couple of days ago, and people can hate that movie all they want to, but the reason why that movie works and the reason why this movie works is the believability of the love story.
This is true for Purple Rose, this is true for Forrest Gump. When you just have a character and an actor who is that charming and sweet and lovable, and in both cases, pretty naive.
My name's Tom Baxter. People call me Tom Baxter.
Oh, I was thinking of Cecilia.
Or Gil Shepard. Okay, although, my name's Cecilia. People call me Cecilia.
And you can just draw people in, and you can then ask them to accept all manner of fantasy and weird things that you include in your film because you're just being carried by that performance. And I know you also like Mia Farrow's performance. I think it's perfect. I think she's perfectly cast. She's just so wonderfully sweet.
It's one of the best things she's ever done. Root Obviously, for, Rosemary's Baby's up there, too.
The fact that somebody as pretty as she is could play an underdog as successfully as she does is another testament to her talent as well.
So Woody's producer, Robert Greenhut, worked with the Woodman for 20 years. In fact, this is one of those kinds of guys like Spielberg and I guess maybe even Scorsese. Bergman, certainly this is true about, too. Worked with a lot of the same technical people over and over again. Because his cameraman, Gordon Willis, did 8 Woody Allen films. And pretty much through the 80s, he did some of the late 70s. But into the, I think, the mid-80s, he worked with Woody over and over again, including, I think, Manhattan is one of those. Willis shot all 3 Godfather flicks. That's what he's best known for. And All the President's Men as well, which we covered way back when. Woody's cutter, Susan Morse, edited 20 of his pictures. And her last with him was Celebrity. I don't know why they didn't keep working together, but they haven't made a movie since then. And then even though the music is generally the old standards, Dick Hyman, who worked on Moonstruck and was an arranger on a lot of other Woody Allen films, was the composer. The movie's 185:1. We watched the DVD with its mix of color and some black and white. It was a spotty print, though. It didn't really look all that great. So what do you think of the look, the cutting, and the classic, but also Dick Hyman music?
Well, like most Woody Allen films, I think that the technicals tend to just not get in their own way. And the fact that it's seamless is the best thing about it. They don't get too ambitious and try to show things that would be too much work to show. The story's going to drive it. We have one big shot where he steps off the screen and a couple of side-by-sides of Jeff Daniels talking to Jeff Daniels, which I know exactly how they did it. It's a rather basic process. And the look is appropriate. It's not showy, doesn't really call attention to itself. I do want to praise the editing. Woody Allen's films are not always the best edited films, but here's a great example of keeping your story as taut as possible. You can never impugn his comic timing. I actually think that is one talent he has that is unimpeachable.
Yeah, he doesn't linger and take forever to get through anything. Matchpoint, I think, is over 2 hours, and it might be the only movie he's ever made that is over 2 hours.
You always want to leave them wanting more. Mm-hmm. You want people to be like, oh, it's over already? That's the best movie.
And that's also what this whole story is about, is that she's left wanting more, and so are we. We want something else for her. But it's a bittersweet ending because she's probably not going to get more. She's going to have to stay with Monk. All right, last thoughts on The Purple Rose of Cairo.
So this may not necessarily be an underrated Woody Allen film, but it is certainly underseen. Like we always said, I would place it among his classics. It's a shame that it's not a more visible Woody Allen movie.
I think that makes it underrated. I'd say it's very underrated.
Well, but critics love it. It has great Rotten Tomatoes scores. People who have seen it love it. And maybe now because Woody Allen has ruined his good name, not enough people are going to see it, unfortunately. It seems to be fading away.
Well, Farrow's excellent. Daniels is really great, although it would have been fun to see Klein give this a shot, too.
Truly.
And I wouldn't want Woody to change that ending for the world. It's the right ending. Just like the ending of Manhattan is her basically being more mature than him, which is, why didn't you say anything about this a while ago? And it's too late. This man knows how to end movies a lot of the time. Annie Hall has the right ending. Manhattan does. Hen and Her Sisters actually is one of the more upbeat, positive endings in any of his movies. But this might be the best ending he's ever had, especially with her looking at that screen for a good long while, too. Okay, in 7 days, the world will still be on lockdown, I'm sure, and we're going to tackle another dark comedy in the vein of American Psycho, which we just did last week, as we review our very first Gus Van Sant flick, To Die For. The coming attractions trivia for To Die For. No one in the To Die For cast had won an Oscar when that film came out in 1995. How many of the actors went on to win a Gold Naked Guy in later years?
So for the answer to that, please check out our next podcast about To Die For. And in the meantime, check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, and lots more titles on top of that. In exchange for all that great content, we don't ask for much. Just perhaps a rating and a review.
And money.
No, we're not asking for money. We just want more fans, and that helps people find us, and we would appreciate that. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project. That's all one word, top100project. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
You should be impressed. I waited all this time to finally do it, but this podcast was well root.
Yes, now that you say it, I am impressed. And cut.